Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. Good evening. This is Ellie Steele. Excuse me. Lyra won't be joining me tonight. She's at a meeting and wasn't able to get back in time for the show, and she sends her apologies. But we're going to... I have a bunch of stuff I wanted to talk about tonight. And we have an interview with Eric Maisel, M-A-I-S-E-L, wrote a book called Brainstorm. I'm hoping I can get to that tonight. Too much trouble. One second. Yeah, I got a number of things I wanted to talk about tonight, and follow up on as well. There's so much stuff there I want to get to. Yeah, Lila. Hello, Lila. I'm on the air. Okay. I thought this was kind of interesting. U.S. says no to indigenous rights. And, U.S. Says no to indigenous rights. This came out in April, but I don't... it's something that I wasn't able to talk about, I think, on this show, and I wanted to mention it. The U.S., this came out April 24th. Actually, it's April 26th on Global Research. And the U.S., self-proclaimed protector of human rights, has failed to vote in favor of the United States Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Speaking to the Islamic Republic news agency at the U.N., Kenneth Deere, the representative of the U.S. and Canada Mohawk Indians, said that Washington had refrained from recognizing the U.N. Declaration on Indigenous Rights. Deere described the condition of the Indians living in the U.S. and Canada as catastrophic, saying that they enjoy the minimum life requirements. He reiterated that despite living in a wealthy country, the Canadian Indians challenge unemployment, poverty, and lack of health care and shelter. They have high unemployment, poverty, and lack of health care and shelter. Deere, who was speaking to IRNA on the sidelines of the ninth session of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, added that now Canada is mulling to reconsider its vote on Indigenous rights, but he said Washington has not moved to review its decision. And on September 13, 2007, the UN General Assembly adopted the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People to protect their lands and resources and to maintain their unique cultures and traditions. About 370 million Indigenous people live in the world, and U.S., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, that are homes to the world's major Indigenous populations, have so far rejected to vote in favor of the U.N. Rights Declarations. Now, to me, I'm pretty sure I read this on my Tuesday night program, but so often I don't get a chance to read them, real noteworthy news that... This was also came out back in April, I wanted to touch on this because I don't think I read this either. I'll pass on that. Other news. totally just, you know what happens to me is I get so many articles that I collect so many articles that I have to, it's even difficult for me to, be able to find them all. But I wanted to just, I'm going to go, bear with me a second. I'm going to check, let me have some updates here. Just to see if there's any changes in the news cycle from yesterday. Food and depopulation, the Rockefeller family. The purpose of this article is to give a brief outline of how the elites, and the Rockefellers in particular, are using food as a weapon. Since the Rockefeller family came to power, especially after gaining a monopoly with Standard Oil, they have manipulated our government into running ruining our financial system by way of the Federal Reserve, energy through oil dependency, and food with GMOs, genetically engineered organisms. And the intention is to rob us blind and kill us. It's time to wake up. The official name of this program is Agenda 21, Sustainable Development. Second. This is from Infowars.com. The overarching blueprint for depopulation and total control, Agenda 21, Sustainable Development, is the overarching blueprint for depopulation and total control over America and the rest of the world. There is no question that Americans are targeted for depopulation. GMO, or genetically modified organisms, food has saturated American farmlands. Did you want to join me, Glenda?
I can't.
Okay. So, let's see.
Crank up, close your window. It's pouring.
Okay. Okay. I'm on the air, you know. Did you know that?
Yes.
Yes, we're on the air tonight, Lila. So, excuse me. Lila has told me to close the window here in my
because it's pouring out.
So may I continue with the show, or would you like to join me?
I can't, because I just got home.
Okay. All right. So Lila says goodbye, and let's see. It's the saturated for American farmers. GMOs are dangerous, and the proliferation of corn crops used as sweetener, animal feed, and processed food, etc. In America, corn crops in America is shortening our lifespans. Our water is polluted, containing over 60,000 chemicals, most of which have never been tested for safety. Our air is toxic, and the U.S. is one of the most targeted areas for chemtrails. This is just the tip of the iceberg. The things we know about. The focus of this article is revealing the link between the Rockefellers and their intended use of food as a weapon, which is more powerful than military domination and energy control. Well, Agenda 21 was introduced in 1992. The elite collectivists, led by the Rockefellers, have been pushing population control in America and the world for generations. In 1992, this depopulation and control policy was modernized and given a name, Agenda 21, or the Agenda for the 21st Century. The premise for depopulation and control is to preserve the environment. One would have to be an idiot to disregard environmental concerns. However, the solution that Agenda 21 offers fails to address the real issues. The primary tools that Agenda 21 Sustainable Development uses are global warming lies, water shortages like the man-made drought in California, which also causes food shortages, and the Endangered Species Act, designed to take away private property, which is the base of wealth creation and freedom. Food control goes hand in hand with the population control. Eugenics, improvement of humans through the selective breeding, often using brutal methods like genocide and forced sterilization. Program of the Third Reich in Nazi Germany was revealed after World War II. Obviously, people did not have a high opinion of eugenics, so according to William Engdahl, author of The Seeds of Destruction, the Rockefeller strategists shifted their profile to champion the causes of the environment, resource scarcity, and overpopulation. The policy of population control remained despite the illusion of caring concerns, which is simply marketing. The word eugenics has been renamed as human genetics. These this scheme of improving their image worked for them before using philanthropy and tax-free foundations, that when the Rockefellers became very unpopular following the Ludlow Massacre. The Ludlow Massacre took place at a Rockefeller-owned coal mine in Colorado. The mines were notoriously unsafe, which caused many deaths, and the workers were paid in scrip currency, substitute that is often credit, to be spent by the Rockefeller at the Rockefeller Company stores. When the workers went on strike, they were evicted from their homes and lived with their families in tent cities. Then they were provoked through murder, machine gun spray, harassment, etc., in order to goad the workers into violence. This was used as a pretext to get the National Guard involved, and the state militia opened fire on the 10 cities, resulting in up to 53 deaths, 13 of whom were women and children. So the Rockefellers created a propaganda campaign to polish their tarnished image through tax-exempt foundations. These foundations are hardly philanthropic. They are used to fund the destruction of America. Please read the excellent interview transcript by Edward G. Griffin to discover the true nature of tax-exempt foundations. And why do you think Senator Jay Rockefeller is pushing so hard to censor the Internet? Today, the Rockefellers use coercive population control tactics and food as a weapon through front organization CIGAR, Consultative Group on Agricultural Resources. As the Rockefellers are trying to distance themselves from public, just like the Rockefeller clan has done. Engdahl reports that CIGAR operates under the umbrella of the UN World Bank, and its primary focus is the spread of GMO crops. CIGAR is created by the Rockefellers and the Ford Foundation, along with the UN World Bank, in 1971, with $350 million a year in funding. The Rockefellers' Green Revolution, which was the implementation of new farming methods in developing countries like Mexico, India, Asia, increased crop yields but ended in disaster. The program lasted from the 1940s to the 70s. Green Revolution, funded by Rockefeller and the Ford Foundation and the U.S. government, was a farming experiment with these results. Hybrid rice was planted that is often sterile in subsequent generations. Intensive water usage, which depleted water resources, use of pesticides and herbicides, which caused cancer but made the manufacturers wealthy, use of synthetic petroleum-based fertilizers that damaged the environment but created untold wealth for Rockefeller-owned Standard Oil, created a monoculture, only a single crop is grown, which means that the food supply can be destroyed in one season. Bill Gates wants to have a new gene revolution in Africa. Bill Gates has teamed with the Rockefeller, Monsanto, and government of Norway in the Doomsday Seed Vault, in which organic seed is stored for some vague anticipated world catastrophe. And the Rockefeller Brothers Fund created the International Service for the Acquisition of Agri-Biotech Applications, and the Rockefeller Foundation is a major donor. The ISAA is involved in promoting proprietary GMO seeds to developing countries. Its sponsors include Monsanto, Dow, AgroSciences, Cargill, USA Bayer, USA Cargill, Crop Science Germany, and a mysterious anonymous donor, USA, and U.S. aid of the State Department, per William Engdahl. It is worth mentioning that Robert Deitch's book, Hemp, American History Revisited, explains that the Great Depression was not caused by the Wall Street stock market crash in 1929, but by prohibition. The 18th Amendment that prohibited alcohol from 1920 until it was repealed in 1933. Other businesses, besides the production of alcoholic beverages that used alcohol, were ruined. Deke claims that the big oil interests like Rockefeller, Mellon, Gulf demonized alcohol not on a propagandized moral grounds, but to eliminate competition. The automobile industry was in its infancy and they wanted a corner on the market on energy, so they devised a plan to knock out the competition of alcohol-powered vehicles. Later, in 1937, after relentless lobbying, they did the same thing with hemp, and through deception and demonization of marijuana, hemp was outlawed. Hemp contains only minuscule trace amounts of THC, the active ingredient in marijuana, yet it is considered a controlled substance. Hemp is a low-maintenance plant that needs no pesticides or herbicides, can produce oil, paper products, biodegradable plastics, medicines, textiles. It is also a super nutritious food. Because the robber barons, Rockefeller and Mellon Oil, DuPont Chemicals and Hearst Paper were threatened, they joined together to outlaw hemp. Hemp was later needed during World War II, so its cultivation was allowed in the U.S. Hemp was a threat to the Rockefellers not only because it produces oil, but also because cannabis has uses as a medicine, thereby threatening their pharmaceutical drug monopoly. And Nelson Rockefeller, as governor of New York, 1973, established marijuana as a Schedule I narcotic through the Rockefeller drug laws, which had harsh penalties for the possession and sales of drugs, including marijuana, that could result in a sentence of 15 years to life. As other states followed suit, it became the cornerstone of America's abysmal war on drugs. This is an extreme... No, it's not. It's not. Only a few more paragraphs here. California is the first state to defy the federal government in decriminalizing marijuana for medical use. Although the 10th Amendment states rights through the 10th Amendment, 14 other states have followed suit. California will vote on marijuana legalization in November. This may pass because the government wants to tax it. Ironically, in 2006, a bill to allow hemp farming passed both houses of California legislature, but collectivist Arnold Schwarzenegger, in another act of cowardice, vetoed the bill because he said the marijuana and hemp are indistinguishable under federal law. Hemp could go a long way towards saving California's bankrupt economy. 15 other states have introduced or enacted legislation to grow hemp, but they fear the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency. Interestingly, California will have an initiative on the ballot in November to legalize marijuana. This means that if it passes, anyone can smoke marijuana for any reason, as opposed to limiting it to medical marijuana use. This is important for two reasons. First, it would open the doors for hemp cultivation for food, oil, natural plastics, paper, etc. And the second reason this is important is because it would nullify the federal drug law, thus enforcing the 10th Amendment for state sovereignty. So, that's an article from InfoWars, and it's a very good article. And I suggest you go to Food and Depopulation, Rockefeller. Back here. There's one other that caught my eye tonight that I thought we should not want to mention. Are you joining us tonight?
Well, I just got home.
Oh, I know, but I didn't know you were joining us. Yes, this is what I want. Could you read that?
In a rational polity, U.S. Obama...
No.
Yes, Obama is engaged in a colossal crime. In a rational polity, the great abomination to earth and man in the Gulf would spell the end of the Obama presidency. We are witnessing a cataclysm on a geological scale, an event with the potential to alter planetary destiny, precipitated not by 300 million year ago year arc of wayward comets or the incremental slide of continent molding tectonic plates, but the routine exercise of corporate power in the United States. The man in charge of the government that both permitted and abetted the heinous corporate crime, drill baby drill, should by all rights be in terminal disgrace. Instead, much of Obama's base behaves as if the first black president is an innocent party, a victim of circumstance, rather than a facilitator of the corporate enterprise that has spawned the mother of all pollution. But then, Teflon is a petrochemical product. That's true. I agree with every word. This is by Glenn Ford, by the way. And any meaningful discussion of the oceanic version of Chernobyl would challenge a political system in which huge corporations are empowered to seek profits with absolutely no regard for the consequence to Earth or man. Viewed from that angle, the only sane perspective, questions of whether Obama is fully or only partially engaged are ludicrous, ill-framed. Engaged in what? In subduing and caging the corporate animals that are defecating in humanity's only nest? Clearly not. BP is the operative government in the Gulf with the Coast Guard as its muscle. BP is also the surgeon in charge of mending the Earth's wound and preventing the spread of septicemia in life-sustaining fluids, the equivalent of Jack the Ripper tending to his own victims. Under such circumstances, the more Obama assures us he is engaged, the greater his confessed complicity in the crime. For purposes of assigning culpability, Obama was fully engaged in setting stage for the atrocity from the moment of his campaign reversal on offshore drilling in August of 2008 after he had the nomination locked up. And this is a quote. My interest is making sure we've got the kind of comprehensive energy policy that can bring down gas prices, said candidate Obama. If in order to get that passed, we have to compromise in terms of careful, well-thought-out drilling strategy that was carefully circumscribed to avoid significant environmental damage, I don't want to be so rigid that we can't get something done. So Obama bent over like a contortionist to pleasure the oil barons. The full scope of Obama's compromise was announced on March 31st. The White House gave big oil virtually everything it wanted politically possible with no protections for the public or Mother Earth in the form of a well-thought-out drilling strategy that was carefully circumscribed to avoid significant environmental damage. The federal government is fully engaged, and I am fully engaged, said Obama last week. Okay, we'll accept that he has been engaged in furthering the oil industry's plan to drill at depths at which current technology makes mistakes irreparable, as the damage from the current ecological holocaust is already irreparable. Obama has engaged in killing the planet in concert with his corporate co-conspirators. He did nothing more than cosmetic changes at the Federal Minerals Management Service, which Obama finally admitted at last week's press conference has been plagued by corruption for years and has had scandalously close relationship with big oil. The unbroken chain of corruption at the agency in both Bush and the Obama administration is one of the small expressions of the continuity of actual rule of the country by sometimes feuding cousins in big oil and Wall Street and the military-industrial complex. The permanent government. Obama is engaged as their servant like his predecessors in the Oval Office. The corporate cousins have raised the stakes of the game. It is either them or the Earth itself. When history passes its verdict on the current era, she will not assign much import to the advent of the first black president of the United States. Rather, history will mark 2010 as a year a servile political operative in the White House espoused the seabed the deep defilement by oil colossus from which the world will never fully recover. Glenn Floyd at blackagendareport.com.
Pretty sick.
Yep.
Pretty sick. And no doubt about it. Pretty damn sick.
U.S. Astronaut is monolith on the Mars moon, Phobos. U.S. astronaut Buzz Aldrin, the second man to walk on the moon, alluded to a monolith detected on Mars moon's Phobos. Speaking on U.S. cable television channel, he said, "We should visit the moons of Mars. There's a monolith there, a very unusual structure on this little potato-shaped object that goes around the moon every 7 hours. Oh, goes around Mars every 7 hours. When people find out what they are going to say, who put it there? Who put it there?" Good question. Who put it there?
Where was that? Oh, well, the universe put it there. Or, if you choose, God put it there. In 2007, the Canadian Space Agency funded a study for an unmanned mission to Phobos, known as Prime, Phobos Reconnaissance and Intelligence Mars Exploration. Phobos is a vastly promising location for future exploration. The moon itself has long been an anomaly. its orbital characteristics suggest it may be
hollow.
And some aggressive speculation suggests that Phobos may in fact be a derelict spacecraft of the Generation Arc variety, described by science writers as a...
Such as Isaac Asimov. Unexplained surface features such as the numerous converging grooves together with the conspicuous monolith-like formations pose the possibility that Phobos harbors uneroded structures deserving of close attention. Ian Fleming, a NASA imaging specialist who has an interest in Mars and other solar system anomalies, Land looked at it and upon further examination and study concluded that the monolith was a physical anomaly on the surface of Phobos. The building-sized monolith is the main proposed landing site because scientists believe the object is a boulder exposed relatively recently in an otherwise featureless area of the asteroid-like moon. Prime investigator Dr. Alan Hildebrand said it could answer questions about the moon's composition and history. If we can get to that object, we don't need to go anywhere else, he told his science team.
Hmm. Pretty good, huh? That was good. That was from the Daily Galaxy. And let's see what else we're going to go here.
Do we have our...
Yep. I'll put that on in just a minute. Okay. BP accused of jet shopping for seeking Republican judge to handle lawsuit. Son of a bitch. Defending your life. Big brain.
Israeli troops issue 10-day eviction orders to Palestinians in the Jordan Valley. Five Palestinian families in the Jordan Valley and the eastern part of the West Bank received eviction orders from the Israeli military on Sunday, just days after Israeli settlers set up an illegal outpost on the family's land and took over a water well in the area. The eviction orders told the family to vacate their homes and land with 10 days so that the Israeli troops could occupy it.
Man, that's pretty sick group of a bunch.
And that's why Helen Thomas said they should go back to Poland or wherever they're from.
Interesting. Investment banker. It's going to get nasty. Buy land, barbed wire, and guns. A top investment banker has warned that the economic fallout of sovereign debt crisis could get so nasty over the next 5 years that people would be wise to abandon the markets and instead buy land, barbed wire, and guns. With gold smashing through its all-time record high this morning, on the backs of fears over a double-dip recession, analysts are turning increasingly bearish on the markets. Anthony Frye, Senior Managing Director of Evercore Partners, told CNBC that the bond markets could turn nasty over the next few months and said that the current problems created by the European debt crisis could be with us for at least 5 years. Look at the current situation. You have Greece, now you have Hungary, and huge issues surrounding Spain and Portugal. You had a warning of a nightmare scenario of a hyperstagflation where inflation rises dramatically but assets prices deflate.
They're not even mentioning Ireland.
I don't want to scare anyone, but I'm considering investing in barbed wire and guns. Things are not looking good and rates are headed higher. An RBS chief strategist, Bob Janjua, echoes Fry's sentiments, predicting the government would inject at least $15 trillion more qualitative easing into that system and that investors should get into gold to offset the depreciating value of the fiat currency. And over the next 6 months, we will see private sector deflation pushing 10-year yields down to 2%, he said. This will see the policymakers mistakenly attempt to kickstart the economy and market with a global quantitative easing program worth between $10-15 trillion. And Drew pointed out that while gold has dramatically risen in value over the last 10 years, the S&P 500 and Dow have both remained flat over the course of the decade. And gold hit a record high of $1,251.85 an ounce this morning as investors continue to flock to the precious metal. And a very real possibility of double-dip recession. So everything looks pretty grim there if you don't buy gold, it looks like.
Or barbed wire.
Or guns. It looks like to me. Well, anyway. I'm going to see if I can play this in 1 second.
Nuclear scientist video points to unlawful U.S. abduction. The mysterious disappearance of an Iranian nuclear scientist took another twist with the broadcast of a video message in which he claims he was abducted by American and Saudi intelligence agents and taken to the U.S. where he is being held against his will. Reuters said that the identity of Shahram Amiri was not independently verified, but the Iranian foreign ministry seemed convinced of the video's authenticity and said that it was now following up legal measures with the U.S. over the case. The video was first broadcast on Iranian state television news on the 7th of June. It apparently shows Amiri speaking in his native Farsi into a computer wearing headphones. He claims that he was kidnapped by the CIA and Saudi spy agency, and that during his detention he was tortured in order to coerce him to make statements that were subsequently reported by ABC. In his alleged confession, Amiri says that he willingly defected to the U.S. and that Iran is conducting a secret nuclear weapons program. Let's see what this is. BP and the White House continue to cover up the oil spill. As BP's latest efforts to stem the flow of oil from the leaking well in the Gulf of Mexico continue to face difficulties, there are now new details emerging about attempts by BP and the Obama administration to cover up the true size of the disaster. It's been revealed that the U.S. Department of the Interior intentionally misrepresented the results of a recent survey of the spill by federal scientists in an attempt to minimize the scope of the real disaster. Tons of Israel keeping Gaza aid seized. Tons of humanitarian aid remains confiscated by Israel, which seized the cargoes in a bloody assault on the international convoy bearing them. The relief supplies amount to 10,000 tons of construction material, medical equipment, and school supplies. The seizures took place during Israeli commandos' confrontation with the multinational relief mission, Freedom Flotilla, in an international waters on May 31st. The attack killed at least 10 activists. Autopsy shows that Israel executed the wounded worse than in Munich in 1972. The really creepy people behind the libertarian-inspired billionaire sea castle. Are we almost ready?
We're ready.
Leo is ready with our interview in just a second. It was a great interview, really. That person was terrific. And his name was Eric. What was the last name of the person that we interviewed?
Mazel.
Eric Mazel. And it was an excellent book. He tells you how to harness your power of creativity and gives you steps to do that. And he talks about obsessing on things. When you obsess in a healthy way, you really come up with some great ideas and know how to do things and work. There's unhealthy obsession, too. That's like not... you're obsessed that the plane might crash or something like that. That's an unhealthy obsession. But maybe a healthy obsession is thinking about all the time how to write a symphony and coming up with that in your mind.
You're talking about the guy coming on now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or how to paint a picture, or how to have a radio talk show if you're an opinionated person like Leo and myself. We harnessed our energy our obsession with our opinions and decided we would have a radio talk show. We have one on Tuesday night on Q103 of an opinion show out of Lakeville, Connecticut.
But it's more than that.
And we have a...
Okay, here we go. Yeah, so, no, it's more than an opinionated show. I mean, we read... we read articles and news and bring updates and interviews.
Yeah, but we also share our personal opinions.
Yeah, of course we do, yeah. Yeah, it's definitely...
And the news we
opinion.
Choose probably is stuff that we're interested in and
yeah.
a slant that we agree with.
Yeah.
We certainly don't agree with a lot of what the mainstream
but
media does.
But
done.
We read stuff we don't agree with, too, because, you know,
yeah,
stuff like, things that we don't agree with, but we'll say we don't agree with it, you know, or read this rule. You know, that kind of thing.
But anyway, this is about
yeah.
obsessions and how to make the most of your obsessions, because it can be a healthy thing. So,
that's what makes us unique amongst the talk shows in the world.
And the name of the book is called Brainstorm.
Yeah.
And it's by Eric Mazel, PhD.
Also, yeah, well,
and his wife also wrote it, but she wasn't on the show, just Eric.
Yeah, so Eric and he's written like 38 books, so it's like pretty amazing. So
I hope you get a lot out of the interview. He was a great guy and fun to interview.
All right, and going to the interview now.
His wife, and interesting guy. He is also the author of numerous other titles, including Creativity for Life, Coaching the Artist Within. And he's an author, a family therapist, a cultural observer, and is widely regarded as America's foremost creativity coach. His more than 30 books include, as I said, Coaching the Artist Within, Creativity for Life, Fearless Creating, The Atheist Way, all kinds of things. He holds degrees in philosophy, psychology, creative writing, counseling psychology. He's a busy guy. He's done a lot of schooling and a lot of writing, and he's actually from, born in the Bronx, New York, and raised in Brooklyn, not too far away, and he's out in California now.
And he's also the author of, I think, 38 books.
Mm.
Yeah, amazing. Eric, how are you?
I'm great, guys. How are you doing?
Welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thanks a lot.
Leo and I got a great kick out of reading your book because we've been obsessed with different things at different times, positively and negatively.
That's right. That's the usual story, isn't it?
Yeah, we got kind of a kick out of that, and we were saying, I was saying to him just before we went on the air, reminding him one of the reasons why we started this show, and we were talking about it, and I said, you know, I was obsessing about the fact that I didn't want this country to go to war, and I was dropping my opinions all over the place. Sometimes well-received and sometimes not. So we both thought it was a good idea to go on the air, and those that wanted to hear us could listen to us. Those that didn't could turn us off.
I think that's a great example of a productive obsession.
Yeah, but you know what really, really, really did it to me was, what really ticked me off was that back in 2003, it was about maybe we agreed to the show right around February, and we started the first show was March 4th. 2003, and we were obsessed at being we were liberal. We were a liberal talk show, and promoted that way. But we were overwhelmed at the conservative insanity that was going on talk radio everywhere, and that every liberal voice and anti-war voice in the country was being fired or assassinated. You know, so we were able to find a station here. And some great guys, and you know, big crowd, and a commercial station with a very large audience. So we were like, you know, it was a, yeah, try it out. So we banged a whole lot of heads, and you know, air seven for 7 years. But it's been purely a productive obsession. It's nothing that I can't,
so,
you know, constantly.
So we were fascinated by your book because naturally it sort of supported what we did. And I think
the rationale.
Yes, at least the rationale. And I think it's a really meaningful book because it helps give people a roadmap, and how to proceed in their journey to really doing something creative and productive.
And I'm sure you guys know that for the last 150 years or so, the clinical world defined all obsessions as negative, as unwanted, intrusive thoughts, so there's never been a chance to even have a conversation about positive obsessions because it's been defined as a negative thing for so long. That was one of the problems I wanted to redress in the book.
I think you did that nicely.
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, what I found myself was being, this book was kind of meant for me in that sense that it hit a lot of nails on the head. It clarified some of my own obsessions with the art, because I was an artist for a number of years, musician. You know, I just had these urges that, you know, to produce something creative, and they just kept leading to different avenues and different things. But I found later to trust those and try to always be able to clear the board, you know, to start a new one. You know, and I just finished a book and put that out, but now I'm now at a point where I'm in that flux. You know, after you do a major project, what do you pursue next? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's why the creative life sometimes mimics bipolar disorder.
No, I fully agree with you.
Yeah, it's actually confusing to therapists who don't understand that the creative life does mimic it. It isn't, but it mimics it. We have these highs sometimes for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Then we hit these lows either after a project is done or while the project's going on, because it isn't going that well. So we have lots of ups and downs.
That's true.
Don't you think, though, that that's the normal ebb and flow of life?
I don't know. I think if you don't really bite into something the way an artist does or a scientist does or a business person does, if you don't really bite into something, you may not have those highs and lows. You know, if you're not obsessed, then you may not get to the end of the obsession and crash. I think a lot of people are living a kind of more straight line life than creative people do. So I think there's a difference there. The creative people are on more of a roller coaster ride than other people.
Well, I think some of your, I was looking at the number of books you've written, but I wish I had read more of your stuff early on, like Affirmations for Artists, The Art of the Book Proposal. The Atheist's Way, Coaching the Artist Within, Creative Recovery, The Creativity Book, Creativity for Life, The Deep Writing. Just a ton of stuff that you have here in the journals.
I've been working as a therapist and a creativity coach with creative performing artists for going on 30 years now.
Yeah, my God.
I just love trying to figure out what's going on and how to be of some help.
Why do you...
About the creativity and depression, creativity and anxiety, creativity and addiction, all the stuff we face.
I thought one that was that you did a fiction book called The Fretful Dancer, and I thought that it caught my eye because of the I could almost see how that would be an obsession. What inspired the book?
What, 35 years ago now, and
when you wrote it?
I'm not really sure what inspired it anymore, but I have a funny story, a sideline story. I just got an email out of the blue from a literary agent in Korea who said that some publisher in Korea was interested in The Fretful Dancer after 35 years.
Wow, no kidding.
I just sent off one of my last remaining copies of it to Korea. I think that's because I just had in the last year four of my books translated into Korean.
Oh, wow.
So I think I'm gaining a little popularity in Korea right at this moment.
Absolutely. Oh, that's wonderful.
I was wondering why we're resistant to obsessing productively. Do you think that's because it's been viewed so negatively, or is there another reason?
I think there are a couple of important reasons. One is the way we grow up.
Mm-hmm.
We're supposed to get things right, you know, in school, and then our parents parrot that message about getting things right, you know, get good test scores and get good grades, and getting things right is the antithesis of obsessing about something, because you need to go into a big open space in your mind to have obsessions, and school really asks us to have lots of small thoughts and organize those small thoughts in a way in which they can be regurgitated. So I think the way we grow up prevents us from learning a lot about obsessions. And then the second thing is thinking makes us anxious. It's one of those things that makes us anxious, and when you get anxious, you want to flee the encounter. So most people don't really want to think hard about things. They want to form quick opinions. You know what, they want to know what they're thinking about something and can get that settled, and they want to think impulsively about things. So between the anxiety and the upbringing, it isn't that easy to cultivate a productive obsession.
Now, did you have an unusual kind of upbringing that you were able to get out of the box?
I think I did. I grew up with my mom, and she gave me complete permission to, you know, buy books and go to the museums and go to the planetarium. I grew up in that environment where I had permission to think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if parents would allow their kids to cultivate some big ideas, at least maybe during the summer or sometime, they'd really serve their kids well that way.
You know, I was just looking at parts of the book here again. You got a section here, it's page 95 of the book, it says Artists Obsessing, and you have quotes by Claude Monet and a few other people. I just wanted to read this one because I thought it was interesting. Excuse me, folks. We have a slight problem here. Jeez. Oh, my God. I've had this for a little while. Hey, Mike. I'm so... tape got stuck in the recorder. Yeah. I hope I haven't run the interview. Probably have. But anyway, we were talking about obsessions, and I have an obsession. I have many obsessions. And one of the quotes that I was going to quote was Claude Monet's quote that he had in the book, regarding is a Claude Monet talks about his obsession with dreaming about the he couldn't get the reflection of the water in the water lilies, and it was driving him crazy. And other great artists are talking about their different obsessions with certain things, and how artistic obsession or what do they call it, productive obsessions, are what actually, you know, lead to creating works of art or any, you know, all types of works of things, and it's quite, you know, it's quite amazing. I'm going to try see if I can play the rest. This is a rather good interview. I'll try right now to see if I can get it to play. Hopefully, what I feel. And Berthe Morris says, I wear myself out trying to render the orange trees so they're not stiff, but like those I saw by Botticelli in Florence. It's a dream that won't come true. So you can see the, you know, and then there's one by Henry Moore. It says, creative habit is like a drug. The particular obsession changes. God. Not having any luck here, folks. I'm sorry. But we're almost at the end of the interview anyway, but what we were saying was is the... Yeah. It's like a drug. Henry Moore stated that it was... that. This obsession was like a drug, you know, to create, and you just want more and more and more, and you go through bouts of depression, and but oddly enough, what he said was really great too, in that he said that you that's part of that's part of what we do as artists or as creative people, you know, for the sake of creating, you know. For the sake of creation, we go through, and unfortunately, humans have to suffer these anxieties in the process, and it's really, it can be quite debilitating at times for certain people, you know, who are prone to manic behavior, and most artists are. Prone to manic behavior. We have the extraordinary ups and downs in life that we almost, you know, expect, you know, being ourselves who we are, to happen. So I've got that tape is wrong. I apologize for that. But maybe I can find this. Ideas, all of these sayings, close the night out with. There it is, artists obsessing. I have a special love for the way this visual, this is the author talking about it. I have a special love for the way that visual artists obsess. We are constantly bombarded by visual stimuli, so a profound task of the visual artist is to create something different from all that already existing stimuli, something that will speak to us through the hubbub of endless visual excitation. What do the productive obsessions of visual artists sound like? Here are half a dozen. These landscapes of water and reflection have become an obsession. It's quite beyond my powers at my age, and yet I want to succeed in expressing what I feel. Claude Monet. I wear myself out trying to render the orange trees so that they're not stiff, but like those I saw by Botticelli in Florence. It's a dream that won't come true. Berthe Morisot. The creative habit is like a drug. The particular obsession changes, but the excitement and the thrill of your creation lasts. That was by Henry Moore. A day without painting, or at least thinking, of something to paint. The day without breathing. And that's Luz Maria Perez. Let's see. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. Your back hurts. Your arms hurt. You've been in there for 10 hours, and there are no sounds except for the occasional fire truck. And finally, you push the brush down, or you put the brush down and ask yourself, man, what am I doing here? That's by John Alexander. And there's a couple more here. Already. Painting seems to be my obsession. I feel some resentment at all the other things in life that take me away from my studio. This obsession constantly judges all other calls on my time and energy. Sue Cowan. I have at times been absorbed in my work to the point of complete self-oblivion. Once I worked for 36 hours without a break to complete exhaustion, and while I was in the middle of it, I didn't even notice. Alton S. Toby. Painter's obsession with his subject is all that he needs to drive him to work. Lucian Freud. I am a painter who paints day in and day out from morning until evening. Gustav Klimt. I don't see how you can create and not have the feeling that it is the most important, all-consuming thing. Grace Hartigan. When you start to work, you don't want to leave, you don't want to eat, and you don't want to sleep. Hugh Lin Wu. Cypresses are always occupying my thoughts. Vincent Van Gogh. And I'm going to leave it at that right now, and I think that's a good place to stop. But your sessions, make them, as long as they're productive, make them productive, you know, because that way they will... know, be productive, it'll last forever, and in some permanent fashion, which is whatever it is that you create. And I'm looking forward to I'm sorry that I couldn't put on the last few minutes of this interview. It was rather good, but hopefully I can prepare it and re-archive it. But anyway, my for those of you listening, if you don't know, I have a new book out. It's called Naked at the Mic. Naked at the Mic, The Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril. And we're having a book signing and open mic kind of thing on the at the WQQQ studio in Lakeville, Connecticut on Saturday between 1 and 3 o'clock. And those of you who might be interested in joining me or calling in, or maybe you bought a book and maybe you'd like to talk about it, or maybe you'd like to talk to us, that phone number is 860-435-3333, and we'll be there between 1 and 3 o'clock, and we'll be taking calls. So, out there. But I want to thank everybody for joining me, and I wish you good night.